he wants to go, which is apparently there. What sort of documentaries do you make? At the moment, not many, but I've only just started, really. I've done a short on Norwegian fishermen, like a kind of homage to Melville. It's sort of local hero meets the old man in the sea, you know? I check to see if I'm boring him. He smiles and nods me on. We talk for 2 hours straight, going through 2 bottles of Krug together, which I assume he'll be covering as the bill would be equivalent to a month's rent in my flat. It flowed easily, the conversation and the champagne. In the moments where he smiled, my thigh would tense involuntarily. Finally, the spell breaks when Mark's friend catches his eye from across the room and gestures that he and his lady friend are off, having come to some sort of hard-fought agreement, one would imagine. On that magical note, I'm going to have to call in a night, I'm afraid. Mark gets to his feet reluctantly. You have to see him back. I stall. I don't want to ask for his number. I want him to ask for mine.
God, no, that would be just... No, thank God. I'll put him in a cab and my work is done.
You? Caro's place is just around the corner. I'll probably crash on her couch tonight. I've done it before, and in all honesty, her sofa bed is far more comfortable than my bed.
You're north, though, right? Your place, usually?
He's stalling now, too. Over his shoulder, I see Richard, loitering passive-aggressively by the stairs. His date must already be up on street level, being bored by passers-by.
Yeah, north, Finsbury Park.
I'm not sure where this conversation is going now. We're floundering. He nods his head decisively, a decision made.
Great, okay. So, long story short, I got this projector for Christmas from my sister, and I'm really having a bit of a moment with it. I've got it shining on this blank wall in my apartment. It's pretty fucking epic. If you fancied it, I've got some documentaries. Long shot, but I've been meaning to watch this 4-hour doc on Nicolae Ceaușescu.
I look at him. Is he joking? Ceaușescu? I really can't tell. This might be the most brilliantly odd invitation I have ever received. I realize I haven't answered him, but he continues to talk, not letting the air out of the situation just yet. Former dictator of Romania sang the Internationale at his own execution. It's too dark, probably. Fancy it? Pretty sexy stuff, right? He had his own tour bus. Well, Ceaușescu bus. He hangs there for a second. He's perfect.
Amazing. That was amazing. I would actually love that. Sign me up.
I pull a freshly minted business card out of my clutch and hand it to him. It's the third time I've done it since I picked them up from the stationers after graduating last month. But it looks well practiced. Fred Davey has one. Caro's got one. And now Mark Roberts has one. I'm free next week. Let's watch the 4-hour Ceaușescu. And with that, I disappear back into the heart of Annabelle's. It takes all of my self-control not to look back over my shoulder as I turn the corner. Chapter 5, Wednesday, July the 20th, Interview 1. Mark calls me from work at 7:23 a.m. Something's wrong. There's panic in his voice. He's stifling it, but I can hear it. I sit up in my chair. I've never heard even an inkling of this tone in his voice before. I shudder slightly, even in the warmth of the room.
Erin, listen, I'm in the loo. They've taken my BlackBerry, and I've got to leave the building right now. They've got 2 security guards outside the bathroom waiting to escort me off the premises.
He's breathy, but he's holding it together. What's happening? I ask, visions of terror attacks and shaky mobile phone footage racing through my mind. But it's not that. I know it's not that. I recognize the bones of this story already. I've heard it from enough people by now. It's eerie in its sterility. Mark's been let go.
Lawrence called me into his office at 7 o'clock. He told me he'd heard through the grapevine that I'm looking elsewhere, and he thinks it's better for all concerned if I take leave from today. He's happy to offer references, but my desk has been emptied already, and I'll have to hand in my work phone before I leave the building.
The line goes silent for a second.
He didn't mention who told him.
Silence again.
But it's fine, Erin, I'm fine. You know, they make you go straight into an HR meeting after they let you go. They lead you out of the room and straight into another one with an HR rep in it. They cover their backs, by God, such a load of bullshit. The rep asks, was I happy here? And then I have to say, yes, it's been fantastic. It's all worked out for the best in the end. Lawrence has done me a favour, freed me up for the next challenge, blah, blah.
Mark's ranting. He can sense my worry through the phone.
It's fine, though, Erin. It's going to be fine, I promise you. Listen, I've got to go with these guys now, but I'll be home in an hour or so.
I'm not home, though. I'm currently in Holloway Prison about to do my first face-to-face interview. He can't have forgotten, can he? I'm in a prison holding room. Shit. Please don't need me there now, Mark. Please be okay. But if he needs me, I'll go. Oh, fucking hell. Those two constantly tugging needs, your own life and being there. Your relationship or your life. No matter how hard you try, you can't have both. Should I come home? I ask. Silence.
No, it's fine,
he says finally.
I need to make a fuckload of calls and sort something out. I need to get in somewhere else before this gets too big. Rafi and Andrew were meant to get back to me yesterday.
I hear a banging on the door on his end.
Fucking hell, just a second, mate. Christ, I'm taking a piss. I gotta go, honey. Time's up. Call me after the interview. Love you.
Love you. I make a kiss noise, but he's already hung up. Silence. I'm back in the hushed holding room again. The guard glances over and frowns. His dark eyes kind but firm. Didn't want to mention it, but you can't use that in here, the guard mumbles, embarrassed to be playing the role of hall monitor. But it's his job. He's doing his best. I put the phone on airplane mode and set it on the table in front of me. More silence. I stare at the empty chair on the other side of the table, the interviewee's chair. I feel a brief shiver of freedom. I'm not in that washroom with Mark. The whole world is still open and clear for me. It's not my problem. The guilt follows immediately. What an awful thing to think. Of course it's my problem. It's our problem. We're getting married in a couple of months. But I can't make that feeling stick. I can't feel Mark's problems like I feel my own. What does that mean? I don't feel like something devastating has happened. I feel free and light. He'll be fine, I reassure myself. Maybe that's why I don't feel anything, because it will all be fine by tomorrow. I'll get home early tonight, I'll make him dinner, I'll open some wine. Wine and fine. A sudden buzzer blast from the electric doors snaps me back to the present. It's followed by the low clunk of sliding bolts. I straighten my notepad, realign my pens. The guard catches my eye. Any point you feel uncomfortable, give me the nod and we'll terminate, he says. I'll be staying in the room, I'm sure they told you. Yes, thank you, Amal. I flash him my most professional smile and press record on the camera, lens trained on the door. Amal presses the door release. The buzz is deafening. Here we go. Interview one. The door release thunders again and a short, fair-haired girl comes into view through the wire mesh window of the door. A pair of eyes land on me. Bore through me, then slide off. I'm standing before the impulse reaches any decision-making area of my brain. The buzzer blast thunders around the room, then the clunk of bolts, the magnets releasing. She steps into the room. Interviewee number one. All 5'3" of her. Holly Byford is 23 and painfully thin. Her long hair messily piled on top of her head. Her blue prison tracksuit loose and heavy on her tiny frame. Cheekbones sharp. She looks like a child. They say you know when you're getting really old because everyone around you starts to look impossibly young. I'm only 30. Holly Byford looks about 16 to me. The door buzzes shut behind her. Amal clears his throat. I'm glad Amal's staying. The prison called yesterday. Although Holly's progressing, they're not entirely happy for her to be unsupervised just yet. Holly continues to stand there, unselfconsciously, halfway into the room. Her eyes play lazily across the furniture, the camera. They skip over me. She hasn't acknowledged me yet. And then her eyes alight on my face. My body tenses. I brace myself. The gaze is hard. It hits me. It's solid. It makes her seem far more substantial than her slight frame.
"You Erin, then?"
she asks. I nod. "It's nice to finally meet you in person, Holly," I reply. Over the past 3 months, our telephone conversations have been brief, mainly consisting of me talking, explaining the project. The silences occasionally peppered by her distracted yes and no's. But now I can see her, I understand that those silences, which sounded empty over the phone, were actually very full. I just couldn't see before what they were full of. "Would you like to sit down?" I offer. "Not really." She holds her ground by the door, a standoff.
"Sit down, please, Holly, or we'll take you back to your cell." Amal fires into the heavy silence. She drags the chair across from me slowly out from under the table and sits demurely, small hands in her lap. She looks up to the frosted window high on the holding room wall. I flick a look over to Amal. He gives me a reassuring nod. "Go ahead."
"So, Holly, I'll just dive in with the questions, just like we discussed over the phone. Don't worry about the camera, just talk to me the way you normally would." She's not looking at me at all, her eyes still lingering on the square of light above. I wonder if she's thinking of the outside, the sky, the wind. I suddenly imagine Mark in a taxi on his way home, a file box of his belongings on his lap, trapped in his own mess. What's he thinking right now as he glides through the city with nowhere to go? Now I look up to the skylight too. Above us, two gulls swoop into the open blue. I take a deep breath of bleached prison air and drop my gaze back down to my notes. I need to stay focused. I push Mark to the back of my mind and look up into Holly's sharp face.
"Okay, Holly, is that clear?"
She lets her eyes flop back down onto me.
"What?"
she asks as if I've been talking gibberish. "Okay, I need to get this back on track. Plan B. Let's just get this done.
Holly, can you tell me your name, age, sentence length, and conviction, please?"
It's an instruction, plain and simple. My tone has slipped into that of Amal's. We don't have time for whatever game this is. She sits up slightly in her chair. For better or worse, this dynamic she understands.
"Holly Byford, 23, 5 years for arson in the London riots,"
she answers briskly by rote. She was one of the thousands of arrests over the 5 days of riots across London in August 2011. The riots began when a peaceful protest at the unlawful shooting of Mark Duggan swiftly escalated into something else entirely. Opportunists, fueled by a sense of self-righteousness, quickly took advantage of the mayhem, and Tottenham descended into chaos. Police were attacked, shops burnt, property destroyed, and shopping malls looted. The chaos spread across London over the next few days and nights. Rioters and looters, realizing they were one step ahead of the police, started to coordinate their attacks via social media platforms. Looters gathered, united, and raided stores, then posted trophy shots of their hauls online. Stores closed, people stayed away, terrified of being attacked or worse. I remember at the time watching the grainy camera phone footage of people smashing into JD Sports, desperate for sneakers, desperate for sports socks. Don't get me wrong, I'm not belittling it. You can only taunt people with the things that they can't have for so long. You can only push people so far. Until, for better or worse, they push back. London was in freefall during those 5 days in August 2011. Of the 4,600 arrests made over those days, a record 2,250 of them went to court. The sentencing was rapid, and it was harsh. The authorities feared that if examples weren't made of the young people involved, then troubling precedents would be set. Half of those charged, tried, and sentenced were under 21. One of them was Holly. She sits across the table from me, her gaze once again on the window above. And what did you do in the riots, Holly? Talk us through that night as you remember it. She stifles a laugh, her eyes flashing across to Amal, looking for an ally, then slowly traveling over to me, her face hardening again.
As I remember it, she smirks. It was the weekend they shot Mark Duggan. I look on Facebook and everyone's doing this crazy stuff. They broke into this retail park thing and they got all this stuff like clothes and that, and the police don't even care and they're not even going there to stop anyone.
She adjusts her messy bun slightly, tightening the knot.
My mate's brother said he was going to drive us up there to get some stuff, but then he got worried about his license plates coming up, so we didn't.
She stops and looks again at Amal. He's looking blankly ahead. She's free to say what she likes.
Anyway, on Sunday, it all kicked off for real everywhere. I got a text from my mate Ash saying that they were about to do the Wick Gift Centre. It's like the main shopping centre in Croydon. Ash said we've got to wear hoodies, cover our faces for the CCTV. So we go down there and there's loads of us. There's crumbled glass all over the ground in the street and everyone's just standing around. So Ash starts smashing through the electric doors of the Wick Gift. The alarm starts going then, so we all join in together because we think there's not going to be much time till the police come. But no one goes through. We just stand there. Then this guy who's running past, he pushes straight through the crowd and he's like, "What are you fucking waiting for, you muppets?" And he goes straight in. So then we push in too. I get some clothes and some nice stuff. Is this what you're after?
She breaks off, her dead-eyed stare on me again, hard. Yes, Holly, and that's exactly what we're after. Keep going, please. I nod her on, trying to stay blank, impassive. I don't want this thrown off track. She smirks again and shifts in her seat. She continues.
Then we get hungry and wander back along the main street. People are throwing stuff, those newspaper dispensers, bricks, bottles on fire, blocking off the road with those big bins. Anyway, Ash joins in, and then when we see the police, we run for it. Ash and me and his mate, back towards the bus station. It's quiet around there, no police, and there's this bus stopped right in the middle of the road, lights on and some people still on it. We want to get safe for a bit, so we try and get on the bus too, but the driver won't open up the doors. Driver starts having a fucking meltdown, shouting, waving his arms around. Then someone opens up the end door and the people on the bus start pouring out the other end because they're scared we're going to jump them or something. The driver's shitting himself because now the door's open and he's not so brave anymore. And then he just runs for it too, so we got the bus to ourselves.
She leans back in her chair, satisfied, eyes cast up to the glass again.
It was nice. We went up top and had a lie down on the back seats and ate some chicken. Had a drink. That's when they got all our faces,
she says it pensively.
Anyway, I poured some Jack Daniels on the back seat and lit it up with one of those free papers as a joke. Ash starts laughing because he didn't think I'd do it, and the whole back bit of the bus goes straight up in flames. So we're all laughing and throwing more papers on it because it's fucking messy up there anyway. And it's burning really hot and stinking, so we go outside to watch. Ash is telling everyone I did it, and now the old double-decker's on fire, people passing, high-fiving and fist-bumping me because it looks completely mental. We got some insane photos on my phone. Don't look at me like that, she snarls. I'm not completely retarded. I wasn't posting the pictures up online or anything.
Holly, how did you get caught? My tone neutral. Her eyes slip off me, challenge dropped.
Turns out I'd been caught on someone's mobile phone footage of the bus on fire and us watching it, Ash saying I'd done it. There was a photo on the front page of the local paper the next day, me watching the bus burn. They used it in court. They got the footage of us on the bus too.
I've watched the burning bus footage. Holly, her eyes bright like a kid at a fireworks display, joyful, alive. Her friend Ash, a menacing wall of muscle and sportswear beside her, her protector. It's unsettling to watch. The laughter, the excitement, the pride. It's chilling given her demeanor now, to know what it takes to make her smile.
And are you excited to go home soon, Holly? I have little expectation of an honest answer here, but I have to ask.
She shoots another look across at Amal. A pause.
Yeah, it'll be good. I miss my crew. I want to put some normal clothes on.
She shrugs her loose sack of a sweater.
Get some proper food in me. They're basically starving me in here. It tastes so disgusting.
Do you think you'd ever do something like that again, once you're out, Holly? I ask. It's worth a shot. She smiles, finally. Sits up in her seat.
Definitely not. I won't be doing anything like that again.
She's smirking now. She's not even trying to lie well. She has every intention of doing something like that again. The conversation is starting to make me feel uncomfortable. For the first time, I wonder if Holly has mental health issues. I want this interview over now.
And what are your plans for the future?
Instantly, her demeanor changes. Her face, her posture, shift. She looks smaller again, somehow, vulnerable. Her tone of voice is suddenly normal. A normal 23-year-old woman, polite, open, friendly. The change is deeply unsettling. I have no doubt that this is the face a parole board will see.
Well, I spoke to the prison charity about helping to speed up my sentence. I want to give back to the community and prove that I can be trusted again. They're going to help me get a job and work with my probation officer to help me get back on the straight and narrow,
she says, full of sweetness and light. I press her. But what do you want, Holly, for the future? What do you want to do with your life once you get out of here? I try to keep my tone flat, but I can feel the flavor of my own words. She smiles again, innocently. She's getting a rise out of me, and she's enjoying it.
That would be telling. I just want to get out of here first. Then, I don't know. You'll have to wait and see, won't you? But expect great things, Erin. Great things.
Her unnerving smirk is back. I look to Amal. He looks back at me. This is the utterly terrifying shape of things. Thank you, Holly. That's a fantastic start. We'll call it a day there, I say. I turn off the camera. Chapter 6, Friday, July the 29th. Giving me away. We're having a dinner party. I know it's probably not the best time for it, given everything that's going on right now, but the wedding is fast approaching. 5 weeks now, and I still need to ask someone a very important favor. They'll be here in an hour. I haven't changed or washed yet, let alone started cooking. We're cooking a roast. I don't know why. I suppose it's fast, and it's easy, and it's something Mark and I can cook together. He's doing the meat, I'm the trimmings. Mark very much enjoyed that as a metaphor for our relationship, when I said it earlier. A rare moment of levity. The joke has quickly evaporated, though, and now I'm standing alone in our state-of-the-art kitchen, staring at a cold, fleshy chicken and a mound of vegetables. Mark's not doing well, hence my lateness today. I've sent him off to get ready. It's been just over a week now since he was fired, and he's been pacing back and forth ever since, in the living room, in the bedroom, in the bathroom, barefoot, while shouting into the phone at people in New York, Germany, Copenhagen, China. We need a night off. I need a night off. I've invited Fred Davey and his wife Nancy over for dinner tonight. It's actually been planned for a month now. They're practically family. Fred has always been there with support and advice ever since I met him on my first job, assisting his White Cube documentary. I really don't think my doc would be in production if he hadn't brainstormed with me and written so many letters with BAFTA letterheads. And lovely Nancy, one of the warmest, gentlest women I've ever met, never misses a birthday, an opening, or a get-together. my surrogate family, my tiny makeshift support structure. There's still no sign of Mark in the kitchen, so I make a start on the food myself. He's been on the phone for half an hour already, trying to chase up yet another lead on a new job. It turned out that the feelers he'd mentioned on our anniversary morning have come to nothing, and that his friend in New York is the one who landed Mark and ultimately us in this mess. By the time I got home, the day he lost his job, Mark had figured out that Andrew in New York had been responsible for everything. Andrew had rung Mark's desk and somehow mistaken Greg's voice for Mark's voice. I have no idea how this happened because Greg is Glaswegian. Anyway, Andrew mistook Greg for Mark and told him that someone from the New York office was going to be ringing him later in the day with a potential new job offer. Greg, creep that he is, no doubt glowing with pleasure, then went straight to their boss and dutifully informed him of the phone conversation. Andrew in New York had apparently not responded well to being implicated in this cock-up and had consequently soured the potential New York job offer. All that maneuvering just to save himself the ignominy of apologizing for the mistake he'd made in the first place. But then you see, in the banking world, apologizing is a sign of weakness. And weakness doesn't inspire confidence, and as we all know, the market is built on confidence. Bull you win, bear you lose. Hence Mark, now unemployed, standing half-dressed in our living room, shouting at the house phone. He tells me that all's not lost. He's spoken to Rafi and a couple of other work friends, and there are at least three possibilities floating around, if not more. He just needs to hang tight for a few weeks. There's nothing more he can do himself at this stage. Even if he gets an offer, he can't start till after garden leave, which means until mid-September. An enforced vacation. At any other time in my life, I would absolutely love that idea. But now that the filming's actually started, I'm going to be swamped until the wedding. Bad timing. As if on cue, he appears, washed and changed in the kitchen. He smiles at me. He looks amazing. White-shirted and freshly scented, he takes my hand and twirls me. We go on a brief, silent dance tour of the kitchen before he holds me at arm's length and says, "I'm taking over. Get up those stairs and make yourself more beautiful. I challenge you." He grabs a tea towel and whips me, giggling, out of the room. Some might find this switch unnerving, but I love that about Mark. He can turn on a dime, compartmentalize. He's in control of his emotions. He knows I need him tonight, so he's there. Upstairs, I agonize over what to wear. I want to seem like I've made an effort, but effortlessly. It's a tricky balance. Tonight, I'm going to ask Fred to give me away at the wedding. It's delicate because Fred's not a relation. He's just the closest thing I have to a father. I respect him. I care about him, and I flatter myself he cares about me too. At least I hope so. Anyway, I hate talking about my family. I feel like people place too much emphasis on where we come from and not enough on where we're going, but anyway, I suppose I need to tell you about my family so you understand. My mother was young and beautiful and clever. She worked hard. She ran a company, and I loved her so much, it hurts to think about her. So I don't. She died. Her car went off a road and rolled down onto a railway track one night 20 years ago. My dad rang me at boarding school the day after and told me. He came to collect me that evening. I got a week off school. There was a funeral. After that, my dad took a job in Saudi Arabia. I saw him on school holidays when I went out there. At 16, I stopped going, choosing to spend the holidays at friends' houses instead. He remarried. They have two kids now. Chloe's 16 and Paul is 10. Dad can't make the wedding. And to be honest, I'm glad. He doesn't make it to much these days. I went over for a visit a couple of years ago, slept in a bare spare room. I know he sees my mother when he looks at me, because that's all I see when I look at him. Anyway, that's it. That's all I'll say on it. When I finally make it downstairs, the air is filled with the heady scents of dinner. The table is laid, best plates, best glasses, champagne, and somehow Mark's fished out some cloth napkins. God, I didn't even know we had napkins. He grins up at me as I enter, his deep brown eyes tracing the contours of my body through the dress. I've gone with a minimalist black velvet dress, my dark hair pulled loosely back to reveal the long gold earrings Mark bought me for my birthday. Gorgeous, he says, looking me up and down as he lights the last candle. I look at him silently. I'm nervous. He stands there, solid-chested and handsome. He sees it, my worry. He sets down what he's doing and he comes over to me. It's going to be fine. It's a lovely thing you're asking. It's going to be fine. He whispers into my ear, holding me close. But what if he asks me about them? I look up at him. I can't talk about it all again. I don't want to think of her. He knows you. He'll know there are reasons you need to ask him. And if he asks, we'll deal with it together. Okay? He pulls back and meets my gaze. I nod reluctantly. Okay, I whisper. Do you trust me? He asks. I smile implicitly, I say. He grins. Well, okay then. Let's dinner party the hell out of this. And with that, the doorbell rings. Chapter 7, Wednesday, August the 3rd. Wedding dress. At knee level, a friendly Irish woman is hemming the folds at the base of my wedding dress. Her name is Mary. I stand there in the delicate Edwardian crepe de chine, observing the whole scene, detached and unsure how to feel. Caro is looking on, my wedding attaché. She helped me find the dress. She knows a few costume designers who work in film. Costume designers tend to have a lot of vintage stock. They buy it up at auction, copy it for productions, and then sell it online, all in mint condition. This gown is one of those. It's perfect. We've come to a tailor's basement in Savile Row for a few tiny alterations. The dress doesn't need much. It fits like a glove. It's the tailor Caro's father used to use when he was alive. I'm not sure how he died. Probably a heart attack. He was old. He'd had Caro late in life. I think she only caught his 60s and 70s. I don't know that much about him, really. Only tidbits slipped into conversation, never enough to grab hold of. There's a check, framed and hanging in her house in the downstairs loo, for £1 million, payable to him. The house itself, left solely to her, is 5 floors in Hampstead, with a garden the size of Russell Square out the back. He was a proper millionaire, an old-school millionaire. At least that's what I glean. There's a wall hole in the living room, propped casually against the wall. So anyway, when Caro gives me advice, I tend to take it, if I can afford it. They're doing my alterations for free. I'm not sure why, but free I can afford. Right, all done, sweetheart. Mary rubs the lint off her knees as she rises. Back out on the street, Caro turns to me. Late lunch? I'm starving. I haven't eaten since last night. In an unusually irrational move, I decided to skip breakfast this morning, not wanting to distort the dress-fitting measurements. I know, I'm going to eat on the actual wedding day. In fact, I'm very much looking forward to it. The caterers we've chosen look amazing. Booked, deposit paid. The menu tasting is next week. Amazing. God, I'm starving. Lunch would be ideal. I check my watch, it's 3 p.m. Later than I thought, but I really need to talk to her. Mark's barefoot pacing is stuck on repeat in my brain. I need to talk about Mark's job. I don't want to, but I have to. I have to talk to someone. Even though it feels like a betrayal talking about our relationship to other people. It's usually the other way round, Mark and I discussing them. We don't talk about each other to outsiders. We're our own unit, impenetrable, secure. There's us, and then there's the rest of the world. Until now. Until this. It's not Mark, though. He's not the problem. I just don't know what to do, how to fix what's happening. Karen must read it on my face.
Come on, we're going to George, she declares.
Yes, George. George will be quiet at this time of day. It's a gorgeous members-only restaurant with a canopied deck set back from the street in deepest Mayfair. Her gallery gets Caro in everywhere. She takes my arm and guides me further into Mayfair. What's up? She demands once the waiter deposits two dewy glasses of ice water and disappears. I eye her as I gulp my water down, the lemon tapping insistently against my top lip. She smirks.
There's no use telling me nothing's up. You're an awful liar, Erin, and you're obviously desperate to tell me, so talk.
She lifts her glass to her lips and sips expectantly. I run out of water. My ice rattles.
If we have this discussion, you have to forget afterwards. Promise me.
I put the empty glass down gingerly.
Bloody hell, babes. Yeah, fine, promised.
She leans back into her chair, eyebrows raised. It's Mark. He's been fired. My voice is slightly quieter than before. I'm aware of the businessman three tables away. You never know.
Huh? Laid off?
She leans forward, lowering her tone to match mine. What a pair we are, bloody hell. No, not laid off. They're paying his gardening leave, but there's no financial package, no lump sum. They made him resign in exchange for references. If he said no, they'd have just fired him anyway, no references. Apparently that's what they wanted to do until his boss talked everyone around to the voluntary resignation.
What? What the actual... That's just ridiculous. Bloody hell. Is he all right?
Caro's shifted up an octave. A businessman swivels in his chair to look over at us. I hush her. It's fine. I mean, he's not fine, but it's fine. It's tricky because I really want to be there for him, but at the same time I don't want to, you know, emasculate him by actually helping him, you see? It's delicate. I have to sort of fluff him up without him noticing. And don't get me wrong, it's not because he needs bolstering or anything. It's because I love him, you know, Caro? I want him to be happy, but he won't let me make him happy. It's like he thinks the worrying focuses him or something, like it's going to help fix it all. I've never seen him act like this, you know? He's always got a plan, but this one's falling apart. This whole EU situation, fucking Brexit, the bottom falling out of the pound, sterling at an all-time low, the government, the new prime minister, the new foreign secretary, for fuck's sake, Donald Trump. Everything is fucked. It's the worst possible timing for this total shitstorm. Caro shakes her head in solidarity. I charge on. And I know as well as he does, it's ruining his chances of getting something else. And not only that, but even if someone is looking, it's going to be hard to sell the idea to a future employer that he resigned from his job before getting another position. He says they're going to wonder why on earth he did that. It just looks weird, apparently. Well, that's what he's saying. But I say, just tell people you didn't like it there. Or say you wanted a break from work before the run-up to the wedding. I mean, it's not a crime to take some time off. But then I do see what he means. It looks weak. To them, I mean. Like he can't handle the pressure and had to take a break. Like he had some kind of breakdown or something. Oh! God, it's so annoying. Seriously, Caro, it's driving me nuts. I can't fix it. Everything I suggest gets battered down. I don't know what to do. So I just sit there, listening and nodding. I stop talking. She shifts in her seat, looks out at the street and nods sagely before answering.
I don't know what to say, hun. It's fucking frustrating. It'd drive me mad.
Mark's a smart guy though, isn't he? I mean, come on, he could do anything, right? Why doesn't he just get another job? He could work in any industry, really, with his experience. Why doesn't he just look for something else?
The answer to that is simple. It's the same answer I'd give if Caro asked me to change my career. I don't want to do something else. And Mark
doesn't want to do something else either. He could, definitely, but, you know, hopefully it won't have to come to that. We're still waiting to hear back about a couple of things. It's just that the wedding's coming up and it feels like he's checked out of it a little bit.
Of what? The wedding planning or the actual relationship?
The planning, I don't know. I don't know, Caro. No, not the relationship, no. I feel bad now.
Is he being an asshole?
Her tone is now uncharacteristic in its extreme earnestness. I can't help but laugh out loud. Caro looks instantly concerned. I guess I'm not acting very characteristic myself right now. I must look nuts.
Sorry, no, he's not. He's not being an asshole.
I glance at her worried face, her crinkled forehead. There's no point in this conversation, I realize suddenly. Caro doesn't know what I should do. She has no idea. She doesn't even know that much about me. Not really. I mean, we're friends, but we don't really know each other. I'm not going to find any answers here. I need to talk to Mark. I'm just making a mess here with this conversation. We should be talking about flowers and cake and hen weekends. I snap myself out of it.
You know what? I think I'm just hungry.
No breakfast, I confess.
Nothing's wrong, really. I think I'm just getting jittery about the wedding and low blood sugar. What I really need, is a Caesar roll and some of those straw chips. And wine.
Caro's smile returns instantly. I'm back. Everything's fine. All stress forgotten. Confession erased. Slate wiped clean. I've turned a corner and she's completely on board. We move on.
Thank you, Caro.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why she is my maid of honor. It's late afternoon when I finally leave Caro, joining the rush hour commuters, tipsy and slow, as they pour underground. On the tube home, I think about what I'll say to him. We need to talk properly. About everything, actually. Or maybe we just need to fuck. That always seems to reset us. It's been 4 days now since we slept together, which for us is long. We're usually at least once a day couple. I know. Don't get me wrong. I know that's not a usual amount. I know that after the first year has passed, that is ridiculously sick-making. I know because before I met Mark, sex was more of a once-a-month ticketed event type of thing. Overhyped and ultimately disappointing. Trust me, I've been in my fair share of shitty relationships. But we, Mark and I, have never been like that. I want him. I want him all the time. His smell, his face, the back of his neck, his hands on me, between my legs. God, I miss him. I feel my pulse racing. The woman in the seat opposite me looks up from her crossword. She frowns. Perhaps she can hear my thoughts. Underneath my dress, I can feel the soft brush of peach silk on skin. Matching underwear. I always wear matching. Since I started dating Mark, he loves silk. I cross my legs slowly, feeling skin against skin. Chapter 8. Saturday, August the 13th. Food tasting. The first wedding-related thing we did after getting engaged was to look at venues. We dived straight in. We went to a lot of places. Quirky, austere, opulent, futuristic, earthy. You name it, we've had a walk-around tour of it. But it was clear once we stepped into the bookish, wood-paneled reception rooms at the Café Royal that that was what we wanted. Whatever that was. Today they're laying on 3 options for every course for us to taste privately in the reception rooms, along with wine pairings and champagne choices. We've been looking forward to this for a long time, but now that it's here, it seems a tiny bit like a formality. It also seems odd celebrating when Mark is going through all this, but we can't put life on hold. In the underground on the way there, Mark reads news on his phone. I try to do the same. At Covent Garden, he turns to me. Erin, listen, I know you're excited about this, but can we just decide now that we'll go for the cheapest option on food and drink? Like, sure, we'll try it all and it will be an amazing day, but money-wise, at the end of it, let's just go for the cheapest, okay? I mean, it's a 5-star restaurant already, so everything's going to be good, so, yeah? Can we agree on that? Is that all right? I see what he's saying. He's right, of course. It's dinner for 80 people. We do need to be sensible about it. And to be honest, their house wine is fucking amazing. We won't need anything more than that. Yes, okay, agreed. Can we do it properly, though? Can we make all the right noises until the end? I want to try it all the stuff. I mean, why not, right? We're only going to do it once. We'll just try it, and then we'll say at the end, okay? He relaxes. Okay, great. Thank you. I squeeze his hand. He squeezes back. Something shifts almost imperceptibly behind his eyes. Erin, thanks for being, you know, I've got a lot on my plate right now, and I know maybe I'm not expressing it in the best way. His eyes drift around the nearby passengers. They're all absorbed in phones and paperbacks. He leans into me, quieter now. I tend to clam up when I'm stressed, and you know, I don't usually get stressed, so it's hard finding my way through this, so thanks. I squeeze his hand harder and let my head fall onto his shoulder. I love you. It's okay, I whisper. He shifts slightly, straightening up in the tube seat. He's not finished. There's more. I lift my head. Erin, I did something last week. He falls silent. He studies my face. My stomach flips. Sentences like that always chill me to the core. Words of preparation for something. Worse news to come. What did you do? I ask it gently because I don't want to scare him off. I don't want him to shut down. Look, I'm sorry I didn't tell you this before. I thought it wasn't the right time, and then the right time didn't come, and then it became a thing, and now here we are. He stops, his eyes remorseful. I cancelled our honeymoon. You what? Not all of it. I've cancelled a week of it. Bora Bora is only 2 weeks now. He studies my face. He waits to see what will happen next. He cancelled our honeymoon. No, he didn't cancel it. He just rearranged some of it, that's all. But without asking me. Without saying anything. Without checking with his future wife. Secretly. And now that I've agreed to pay less for the food today, he's decided that it's okay to tell me. Right. Okay. My mind races as I try to process it, to find out what this means, but nothing comes. Is it important? Maybe it's not. I can't really make myself care. I can't make myself care about a vacation. It doesn't feel like a thing. Dare I say it? I don't mind. Should I mind? But then maybe the point is, he lied. Yes. Or did he? He didn't really lie, did he? He just did something without telling me, and come on, at least he's telling me now. But then he had to tell me at some point, right, didn't he? What was the alternative? Not tell me until we were on the plane? No, of course he would have told me. It's fine. I've just been busy. I've been too busy with work. Besides, 2 weeks on a tropical island is fine. More than fine. Bloody fantastic. That's more than some people get in a lifetime. And I don't need any of it anyway. I just want him. I just want to marry him. Don't I? We'll work it out later. But right now, I won't scare him away. Won't make it worse. He's made a mistake, and he's sorry. So that's it. I raise his hand, still interlaced in mine, and kiss his knuckles. It's fine. Don't worry about it. We'll have a chat about money later. Let's just have a lovely day, okay? He smiles, eyes still sad. Done. Let's have a lovely day. And it is a lovely day. In the twinkling mirror and oak-paneled ballroom, we sit at a white cloth table floating adrift on a sea of buffed parquet flooring. A cheerful waiter brings us intricate plates, artfully arranged with seasonal fare. Once all the starter options are placed on the table, the maitre d' explains each one and hands us a discreet card listing the dishes and prices, and disappears back through the oak panelling, leaving us to it. We peruse the card. Starters. Lobster with watercress, apple, creme fraiche vinaigrette, £32 per person. Rock oysters with shallot vinegar, lemon, brown bread and butter, £19 per person. Asparagus with quail egg, beetroot and celeriac remoulade, £22.50 per person. Times that by 80 people, and that's just the starter. I look at Mark, he's gone white. I can't help it, I burst out laughing. He looks at me, relief written all over his face. He smiles and raises his glass to toast. I lift mine. To not having starters? To not having starters, I chuckle. We dig into the delicious entrees and they're worth every single penny. I'm just glad we won't be the ones paying for them. We opt for a main course of Café Royal homemade chicken pie with bacon, quail's egg, fine French beans, and mousseline potatoes. £19.50. For desserts, we go for dark chocolate and wild cherries, dark chocolate crémeux and wild cherry compote. £13. Plus 30 bottles of house red and 30 house white and 20 bottles of sparkling wine. We think we've done a pretty good job until the maitre d', Gérard, sits down for a post-coffee chat. Apparently, the minimum spend is £6,000. They must have told us that last year when we booked, but we obviously weren't listening. And even if we were, it wouldn't have seemed important then. Gérard tells us not to worry. We can simply bump up to that price by adding after-dinner coffee and a cheese board for 80 people, adding another £1,300 to our total. We agree. Well, what else can we do? The wedding's in 3 weeks. Afterwards, stuffed and brimming with buyer's remorse, we descend into Piccadilly Station. Before the turnstiles, Mark takes my upper arm and stops me. Erin, we can't do this. Seriously, it's ridiculous. It's way too much, right? I mean, come on. We need to cancel it when we get home. Lose the deposit, sure, fine, but just cancel it. We'll do the wedding part in All Souls, and then we'll go to a local restaurant or something. Or up to Mum and Dad's. They could do a village hall thing, right? I look down at his hand, tight on my arm. This isn't someone I recognize. Mark, seriously, you're scaring me a bit now. Actually scaring me. Why are you acting like this? It's our wedding. We've got savings. It's not like we're taking out loans to cover the cost. You only do this day once in your life, and I personally want to spend my money on this. On us. I mean, not all of my money, obviously, but a bit of it. Otherwise, what's it all for? He sighs hard through his nose, frustrated. He abandons the conversation, his hand releases me, and we descend underground. The rest of our journey is spent in silence. I watch other people on the tube, wonder about their lives. Sitting next to Mark but not talking with him, I imagine I don't know him, that maybe I'm just a girl on the tube going somewhere on my own, that I don't have to worry about what happens next, or the rest of my life, for that matter. The thought is calming but ultimately empty. I want Mark. I do. I just wish I could shake him out of this mood. I wish I could fix it. He turns on me as soon as we get through the front door at home. His voice is no longer the whisper it was in the station. He tells me I don't understand. I'm not listening. I've never seen him like this, as if something inside were bursting to come out. I don't think you really appreciate what is going on here, Erin, do you? What's actually happening? I don't have a job anymore. There is no money for any of this, and I can't get another job. No one is hiring. My world is not like it is in the arts, or your film school, or whatever. I can't just jump ship and do something else for a living. I'm an investment banker, that's what I do. I'm not trained to do anything else. And even if I was,
It doesn't matter. I can't just set up my own bank or, I don't know, collaborate on a postmodern banking project or whatever the fuck. I'm not like you. I don't come from the same place you do. I spent my whole life getting to where I am now. My whole life. Do you know how hard that was? People who went to my high school work in petrol stations, Erin. Do you understand that? They live in council flats and stack fucking supermarket shelves. I will not go back to that. I will not let that happen. But I don't have a backup. I don't have family, friends in publishing or journalism or fucking winemaking. I've got a retired mum and dad in East Riding who are both going to need looking after before too long. I've got a total of 80 grand in savings and the rest tied up in this house. And now we're trying to have a baby. I had a real job. I've lost it and we are screwed. Because unfortunately, we don't all have the luxury of being paid for like you do. I feel the bile rise up inside me. I've had enough. Enough of this for today. Fuck you, Mark. You're being a fucking arsehole. When have you ever paid for me? When? What am I, a fucking hooker? This was supposed to be a lovely day. No, Erin. No, you're not, sadly. Because if you were, you'd shut the fuck up about now. My heart skips a beat in my chest. Fuck. Mark has gone, just like that, and a stranger is standing in my living room. Fucking hell. My breathing becomes shallow. God, don't cry, please don't cry, Erin, just breathe. I feel the prickle behind my eyes. Mark looks at me. He mutters something inaudible, then turns away and looks out the window. I sit down in silence. I can't believe you just said that, Mark, I whisper. I know I should let it go. No, no, I shouldn't let it go. Fuck that. I have to marry this man in 3 weeks. If this is going to be the rest of my life from now on, I want to bloody know. Mark! What, Erin? What do you think we're going to do after the wedding? If we do have kids? What do you think is going to happen? My job pays for everything. It paid for this house. No, Mark, no. We both paid for it. I put my savings into the deposit too. Everything I had. I blurt out, my voice rising to meet his. Okay, great. That's great, Erin. You put your money in too. But you can't pay all the mortgage on your salary, can you? I mean, we don't live in a one-bed flat in Peckham, do we? There's absolutely no way you can cover the mortgage on your own with what you earn. I don't mean to upset you, Erin, but you're not listening. We're going to have to sell the house. Obviously. Sell it? Oh my God. I must look terrified because he nods now, satisfied. I don't think you've really thought about this at all, have you? Because if you had, then honestly, Erin, you would be just as worried about this as I am. We're going to go under. Oh my God. I'm silent. I've been an idiot. I see that now. This hurts. None of what he's saying had occurred to me. I hadn't thought about the fact that all our plans might simply fall through. That he just might not get another good job at all. He's right. No wonder he's angry. He's been dealing with this alone. And I've been flouncing about acting as if... But then I remember. It doesn't have to be like that. Like Caro said, he could just do something else. But Mark, you can just get another job. Any job. You've got a great resume. Can't you just... No, Erin, he interrupts wearily. It doesn't work like that. What the fuck else am I going to do? All I'm qualified to do is price and sell bonds. Nothing else. Unless you're suggesting I work in a bar. Mark, please, I'm just trying to help, okay? I don't know exactly how your industry works, do I? I just want to be in this together, so please stop saying that I don't understand and just explain it to me. Please. I know I sound like a petulant child, but I don't know what else to say. He sags down on the sofa opposite me, drained. His shoulders hunched. An impasse. We sit in silence. The low hum of traffic and wind through the trees in the garden just audible. I get up and go over to sit next to him. I reach out and touch his back gently with my hand. He doesn't flinch away, so I start to rub it softly with my palm, soothing him
stroking his warm back through the starched cotton shirt. He lets me. Mark, I say tentatively. It's okay if we sell this place, I continue.